Hello, everyone. My name is Jimmy Bowman, and I'm an alcoholic. Everybody just runs off and leaves. I don't know. I don't know what it is. I'm up here all alone now. Come on, some of y'all come on back. I am asked from time to time, do I get nervous prior to my coming up and speaking to a group such as this? And I think my answer is probably no. I think nervous is when you come to out in the backyard naked and you're not really sure how you got there. Now, fear, on the other hand, is when you come to and realize you have drank your Sunday liquor on Saturday night. That makes for some long, tough hours now, I don't mind telling you. And that used to happen to me more often than not. I have to sneak into the kitchen and wonder what happened the night before. But thank God for you people, and I don't have to do that anymore. You know, it's just great. I want to thank the committee for inviting me over to speak. It's an honor anytime, anyone, anywhere asks me to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's very, very difficult for me to say no to AA, and I seldom ever have to. If I do, it's something else that is AA-related that I would have to say no to. Because, you see, AA never said no to me. There were so many times, you know. I know I'm the only person in here tonight that's picked up more than one white chip. I think the hardest chip I ever picked up in my life was my second white chip. You see, I had to amble up there that night, and I had to admit to you and to God and everybody else in that room that night that I couldn't make it, that I had been a failure once again, and I was going to need another white chip. Now, about number six or seven, they start getting a little bit easier to pick up. 9 or 10, you just go bopping on up there. They, you know, kind of flip them out to you. Now, when you get up to about 19 or 20 now, they're going to quit clapping for you. They're going to say, well, there's Jimmy, he's drunk. At least that's what they did with me. But I'm so grateful you folks never said no. You said, keep coming back, Jimmy, we need you. Keep coming back, we love you. We got to have you. I'm often reminded of my sponsor's story, and his story is a lot more interesting than mine. I think I'll just tell his. Jimmy Smith was one of those that picked up more than one white chip. I remember my first AA meeting. I live in a county of about 9,000 people. 7,000 of those people thought I had a problem with alcohol. The other 2,000 knew I had a problem with alcohol. And my wife was one of the 2,000. And she suggested that I might call a friend that used to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, those AA meetings, you know. And so I called this friend, James Johnson, and James is dead now. And he and his wife were going to take me to that meeting. He said, now, Jimmy, it's not a meeting in Washington tonight. There used to be a meeting in Washington, but they had closed up that meeting. They had cured all the drunks in Washington, so it was no longer necessary to have a meeting. But there was a meeting the next night in Thompson, Georgia. So I said, James, would you mind taking me? He said, I'll be glad to, Jimmy. He said, now, it's tomorrow night. He said, now, don't drink nothing, because I want you to, you know, be ready for that meeting. So that next day, now, I didn't drink but about 3 or 4 beers because I wanted to get the full benefit of what was going to take place that night. Well, he and his wife, Mabel, they came and picked me up, and sure enough, down to Thompson we drive, and we had a good chat on the way down there, and we were getting ready to get out of the car at the AA clubhouse there. And he said, now, Jimmy, let me tell you about something before you go in. I said, what's that? He said, there's going to be a guy now. He's going to probably run in the front door. And he's going to hug all the girls, and he's going to kiss all the women. He's going to pat 2 or 3 of them, and he's going to run out the back door. And a few minutes later, he's going to run in the front door again. He's going to hug all the girls and kiss all the women and pat 2 or 3 of them and run out the back door again. I said, but don't worry about him now. He's got brain damage. I said, okay, I won't. Well, I went into that meeting that night, and, you know, that guy wasn't there that night. I was to meet him later on, thank God. The next meeting I went to down there, and this guy, you know, he was there. And sure enough, he ran into the front door, and he hugged all the girls, kissed all the women, patted 2 or 3 of them, and out the back door he went. Right around the building he comes, and right through the front door again, doing the same thing over and over again. So I asked him to be my sponsor. I like the way this guy worked the room. Yeah. You know, he had it going on. You know, yeah. This is my kind of guy. But see, Jimmy, he did. Like I said, he picked up more than one white chip in his lifetime and in his journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started this deal sometime in the early 70s. Now, if you take note later on in my story, you will see my sobriety date and my first AA meeting date do not coincide. But I kept coming back. I kept coming back. They used to tell Jimmy, said, Jimmy, keep coming back. We love you. And he'd go out and he'd get drunk. And he'd come back and they'd say, keep coming back, Jimmy, we love you. And he'd go out and he'd get drunk and he'd come back. Finally, they said, keep coming back, Jimmy, we need you. I said, now, wait a minute. He said, I can understand you love me, all that, but why do you need me? I said, well, we show you to the new people. And we tell them if they keep drinking, they're going to end up just like you. But you know, I love Jimmy Smith. Jimmy Smith was my sponsor until the day he died. We buried Jimmy Smith with 19 years sobriety a couple of years back. Jimmy Smith was my sponsor. He was not my best friend. I think probably about the kindest thing he ever said to me was, boy, I don't think you're going to make it. I needed to hear that, you know, from him. You know, and somebody told me early on, said, now, Jimmy, if you want a best friend, go buy a dog. You know, your sponsor is not going to be your best friend. But I love Jimmy Smith, you know, probably more than I love my daddy. But he never was my best friend. But he taught me what was in and what was out in AA and the things that I should do on a daily basis just to get that daily reprieve from that one drink of whiskey. And I followed his lead or tried as best I possibly could to do exactly what he told me to do. And I miss it today. I truly do. It is great to be over here in Columbia. I get to see a lot of friends that I don't get to see very often, and I won't go to calling names. I don't want anybody to get a resentment. I left them out. They'll go get drunk and blame it on me. So, but you know, all know who you are, and I'm glad you're here, and it's always a pleasure to see you. My story is not unique. It's not very pretty. Wasn't that exciting. You know, I didn't document all these things when I was drinking. You know, I didn't think it was going to be important later on. I never thought I'd be over here in Columbia on the 26th and sharing my experience, strength, and hope with you people. But as best I can recollect, it went something like this. I'm going to skip back a couple of generations to my paternal grandfather, who was an Indian man. And I only bring that up for two reasons. One being, I never met an Indian that drank whiskey that wasn't a drunk. And when he drank, he ran. And then my father came along, a half-breed Indian man, and he drank whiskey, and he was a drunk. And when he drank, he ran. And then I came along, quarter-breed Indian kid, and I just didn't fit. There was something missing in me. You know, when God decided that he was going to give everybody all this stuff that put inside of them to make them feel good about themselves, he forgot mine. Something was left out of me. I didn't know what it was. But as it turned out, I drank whiskey, and I was a drunk. And when I drank, I ran. I didn't know what that deficiency was in me, and I wasn't to find it out until very much later on. In my sobriety, did I find out what that was. But I am the alcoholic son of a drunken mother and a drunken father. Alcohol killed both these people. It's sad that they didn't find this fellowship that we hold so dear today. But, you know, I've come to terms with that. I was raised by my grandparents who loved me very, very much. And I'm so grateful to both of them for what they did for me. My mother had, my parents were divorced. My mother remarried. And she moved over to Greenwood, South Carolina from over in Wilkes County, Georgia. And as a matter of fact, my drinking career started, you know, over in Greenwood. I used to run with the older boys, the guys that had the car, and they knew the girls. And we'd get out and we'd ride around. And my drinking started very innocently one night, right over there close to the Bryce Street Group, as a matter of fact. At the old ranch drive-in, which was right downtown Greenwood at that particular time. And I don't know how it happened. It was so innocent. One of these guys said, Jimmy, how about a beer? I said, I think I'll have one. I guess I was about 13 years old. And that night I was standing outside that car out there in the back of the ranch drive-in drinking that beer. Two things happened that night. One was I learned I detested the taste of beer. Why anyone would ever go to the effort to drink that stuff was simply beyond me. It was just awful. Second thing I decided was I was never, ever going to drink again. So I drank about half of that beer, and when nobody was looking now, I snuck around the front of that car, and I poured out that beer, what was left of it. And I continued to act just like I was drinking the whole rest of the night. You see, I wanted to fit in. I started playing these games with these folks. The more my friends drank, the drunker I got. You know, I was just having myself a ball. Also, about this time in my life, I started talking to myself. You know, and I'd been going out with these guys for quite some time, and after that drinking experience, I continued to go out with these guys. I just didn't drink. Well, you know, here I am. I'm talking to myself. I said, Jimmy, you know what? No, what? Well, there's a possibility now, this drinking business, maybe you didn't do it right the first time. Why don't you try it again? And I said, well, I think I will. So the next time I went out with these guys, excuse me, I did it just right. I drank just as much as I could possibly drink. I got just as sick as I could possibly get. I threw up just as much as I possibly could. I went into my first blackout, and I passed out for the first time from alcohol. Little did I know at that time that somewhere in that two-week period from my social drinking, a half of a beer, I had crossed that imaginary line that we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous to alcoholic drinking. Unbeknownst to me, I was to be a blackout drunk for the next 27 years. I didn't know you could drink it any other way. And if you could, why would you? You know, I was never the type to walk around with a glass and call it a martini. Or, you know, I never did stick olives down in anything and nothing like that. I threw it in a brown paper bag, and that's the way I drank it. You know, I put it down there in that hole where it'd do some good. You know, the more it burned, the better I felt. You know, I wanted that jolt. You know, alcohol did not make me better than. It didn't make me worse than. It just made everything okay. It made everything fit. You know, I didn't especially want to participate in a whole lot of things. I just wanted to observe it. You know, I could take that bottle of hooch and I could sit on that porch and I could just lean back and I could watch life just drive by. It made everything just slide. It was a social lubricant for me. And I loved all there was about it. Also, about this time in my life, I started being done with things before I had actually completed them. Hadn't been too long after that, a couple of years, I would imagine, that I felt that Greenwood had certainly grown tired of me. And it'd be in my best interest to probably leave Greenwood because I was running with a pretty rough bunch. So I moved back over to Wilkes County, Georgia with my grandparents, and they were glad to have me back. And I hadn't been there too long. Of course, my problem with alcohol, it caught up with me. It followed me on across the river there. And here I was only 15 years old, and you just don't go anywhere because you got to have a driver's license. I didn't have a driver's license. You got to have a car. I didn't have a car, so I got to hanging with the older guys. They had the car. They knew where to go. That's when I found out where the bootleggers were. You know, when you're 15 years old, a bootlegger don't care how old you are. They ask how much you got. It doesn't make any difference to them. So, you know, we'd be riding around with those guys, and it'd be late in the evening or early at night, and we'd go up to that bootlegger's house, and we'd knock on that back door. He'd come to the back door. What you want, boy? Give me a six-pack. We're riding around out here. So we'd take that six-pack, and we'd be out riding those country roads in Wilkes County, Georgia, and we'd drink that six-pack and be right back at that bootlegger's back door. What you want this time, son? A pint of wine. Now, we're getting it on out here. So we'd be riding around, we'd be drinking that wine, and, you know, we'd be back at the back door of that honky-tonk. Finally, he come out and said, boy, you worry me to death. Now, you got to just come on in here. I can't keep running back and forth with you all night long. So finally, I was introduced into the honky-tonk. And I loved everything there was about a honky-tonk. I still do, I guess. You know, I like to spill beer all over the place. I like to dust all over the floor. I like cigarette butts everywhere. I like old rusty records on the jukebox. I just liked everything there was about it. I liked the old occasional drunk. He's laying over there. He can't get up and he can't lay down. He has absolutely no idea what he's doing. And I wanted to be this guy. You know, this guy fits. Everybody respects this guy, you know. God, did you see that? You know, everybody talked about him. You know, that was so cool. Everybody, oh, man, yeah, he was all right. You know, that's the guy. Anyway, about this time in my life, I gained what you would call more than a casual interest in the opposite sex. And I started going out with these pretty girls. I was never, you know, I was never the best-looking kid around, don't get me wrong, but I never was what you'd consider butt ugly either. So I always had a little bit of female companionship. And I'll tell you all something about it. I'd love to think that everybody in this room tonight would walk away from here and never, ever drink again. I'd love to think that, but I doubt that's going to happen. I doubt that's going to happen. And that's sad. But I got a hint for you, man. When you do go back out there and you do try to court these pretty little old girls, you do not have to buy the good stuff. As a matter of fact, I encourage you, do not buy the good stuff. You are in a win-win situation when you buy the cheap stuff. Because if you buy the cheap stuff, there's a good chance she's not going to like it. And there's going to be twice as much for you. And if she does like it, you ain't going to be out that much money. So always, you know, always get the cheap stuff. You'd be so much better off. Anyway, I went on and graduated from high school without honors, by the way. And I decided I was going to go to college. I was going to go to this little college down in Cochran, Georgia, called Middle Georgia College. And I remember talking to that dean that day, very nice man. He said, "Jimmy, we're glad to have you down here from Wilkes County." I said, "Yes, I'm glad to be here." He said, "Jimmy, in order for you to stay in Cochran, Georgia, a certain amount of study is going to have to be taking place." I said, "Yes, I understand that." I said, under my breath, "If I'm going to live in Cochran, Georgia, a certain amount of drinking is going to be taking place." Well, you folks will be happy to know that it didn't take those folks down in Cochran but 2 quarters to figure me out. And they decided if I was going to continue my education, I wouldn't be doing it at Middle Georgia College anymore because I was not going to be welcome in Cochran much longer. So I went on back home and got me a job in a little old mill, and I'd been working this little old mill for a couple of 3 weeks or so, and here again I'm still talking to myself. I said, "Jimmy, you know what your problem was?" "No, what?" "Well, you went to the wrong school. That's what your problem was. Why don't you try another place?" I said, "Well, I think I will." So I enrolled in Augusta College down over here across the river in Augusta, Georgia. And I remember talking to that dean that day. Very nice man. Said, "Jimmy, I understand you had your problems down in Cochran." I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "Now, Jimmy, I hope all that's behind you, because in order for you to stay down here in Augusta College, a certain amount of studying is going to have to be taking place." I said, "Yes, sir." And under my breath, I was saying for me to drive back and forth to Augusta every day, a certain amount of drinking is going to be taking place. You folks will be happy to know now, the closer you get to Columbia, South Carolina, the smarter these people start to get. It didn't take them but 1 quarter for the, you know, down there to figure me out. And I wasn't welcome in Augusta anymore. So here I am, you know, I kicked out of 2 schools, didn't have a lot of money to start with, wasn't educated in anything. What am I going to do? Well, I get a job in another little old mill there in Washington. By this time, I had narrowed down my honky-tonk business to a place that was called Wayne Waller's Beer Joint. And God, it was a classic. You know, you could feed chickens through the floor in this honky-tonk. You know. It had old bus seats that, you know, that come out of old school buses that you sit around on and drink that cold draft beer. It had old pot-bellied stove out there in the middle of it. I was out there one night, and they got in a fight, and the pot-bellied stove knocked over, and soot's flying all over the place, and everybody's flying out of Wayne Waller's beer joint, and I feel like I'm in heaven. You know. I was so proud I was there that night, I didn't know what to do. I told everybody I knew. Anyway, I get off work and I'd head just as straight out to Wayne Wallace as I could go, and we'd tell lies and talk about women. You know how we are. And I was out there minding my own business one day, and a friend of mine came up to me, and we started talking. I'm very much like a good friend of mine, Tommy McNeil in Thompson, Georgia. Tommy's dead now. We buried him with 17 years sobriety. When Tommy and I drank, we broke out in spots. Some of the spots I broke out in Canada on 3 different occasions. I broke out in Mexico on 3 different occasions. I've broken out in several of the Midwestern states. I've broken out in every state in the South, from Georgia to California. The furthest breakout I ever had, I broke out one time in Sydney, Australia. And this thing hit started innocently enough. I never know how they happen. I never know. I'm sitting on a bar stool at Wayne Waller's Beer Joint, minding my own business. And a friend of mine comes over and says, "Jimmy, you've been to Canada a couple of times, haven't you?" I said, "Well, yeah, I have." He said, "Did you like it?" I said, "Yeah, I did." He said, "Have you ever been to Australia?" I said, "No, I haven't." He said, "Would you like to go?" I said, "Yes, I would." We left. You know, he got the tickets, you know, and he bought this old beat-up Mercedes, and we drove across the southern United States, and I got, of course, drunk in every one of them. And there we are, traveling to Australia in a Mercedes. Yeah. And we end up in a little town called Sausalito, California, which is just across the Golden Gate Bridge out there in California. He knew a couple of girls out there, and we were staying with them until the ship came in. He sold that Mercedes, and we rented a car. I don't know how this happened. It was either late one night or early one morning. I never could too much tell the difference. But I was driving that rental car right downtown in Sausalito, California, and I wrecked that rental car. Now, what happened was I ran over a parked car. It just happened. Well, see, it wasn't my fault. What had happened was that guy should have known better than to leave that car parked there that night, because some fool left it there long enough was going to hit it. And here I come, and I'm the one that hit it. And since it wasn't my fault, I didn't stop. And I left. Anyway, he took that rental car back to the rental place. I don't know how he explained his way out of that, but we hid out in Sausalito for two more days, and that boat came in, and somehow he managed to get us on the ship. Our first stop was Vancouver, British Columbia, and we got off the boat, stopped in the first bar we could find, and of course I got drunk. He got us back to the ship that night. Next morning we took off, set sail again, going somewhere. The next stop, I believe, was Honolulu, Hawaii, and we were going to be in Honolulu for 24 hours. So he rented the car, we went to the liquor store, and I got drunk. He managed to get us back to the boat. Geographically, right along here, I'm not sure which was next. I think the Fiji Islands. We pull into the Fiji Islands, a very primitive place, if I remember correctly, but the time I spent in the Fiji Islands, I spent in the bar. We were less than 24 hours there, and I spent all the time in the bar, right there in the Fiji Islands. He gets us back to the boat. Auckland, New Zealand, next stop. Beautiful place, you know. Here I am, you know, I need to go see some of this stuff. I can't see through that alcoholic blur, you know. I'm waiting for a bar to open. That's all I care about is what time is the bar going to open. I'm walking the streets until one does, you know. And so I go into this bar. And he gets us back to the boat. Our next stop, of course, was Sydney, Australia. We pull into Sydney Harbor. And that's when I took my very first inventory, right down there. I pull out my wallet, and I look at all the sadness that's there. And here I am, you know, I'm 12,000 miles away from home. And I'm going to a country that I don't know a living soul. I'm sick with the flu, and I got $9 in my pocket. Somehow or another, I managed to talk a cab driver and taking us to for a place to stay that night, and he graciously did. And I stayed at that place 24 hours trying to beat that flu as best I could. And here again, I'm still talking to myself. Well, Jimmy, what you going to do? Well, you got to get a job, fool. You can't stay over here for nothing. Well, you know, here I am, unskilled, and where does a good drinking drunk go to get a job? I don't know where you go, but I go to the bar. That's the only place I know to go to. As it turned out, they weren't hiring that day. But some of the miracles in my life began to happen in that very bar right there in King's Cross in Sydney, Australia. I'm sitting at that bar minding my own business, nursing a cold drink. All of a sudden, I look around and hear some guy, he slid up here on this side of me. And there would be a gal, she'd come over here and she'd slide in on this side of me. I'm talking to the bartender and these folks are looking at me funny. And finally, you know, one or two of them, they said, where are you from? I said, well, I'm from Georgia. And God, they just howled, you know. They never had heard anybody talk regular like we talk. I mean, they just, you know, they just went into fits. They could not believe it. I said, yeah, that's where I'm from. And, you know, I do this and I do that. And finally, one of them says, well, Jimmy, how about a beer? I said, well, one, you know, will be nice. So they start buying me beer, you know, and when it gets time to get something to eat, they buy you something to eat. And then one of them grabbed you, and he said, look, we need to go across town. There's some of these folks you need to talk to over there, too. I said, well, let's go. So, you know, here I am. I'm drug across Sydney, and I'm talking to folks I've never seen before. And they seem to enjoy it because they keep paying. You know, to make a long story short, that $9 lasted me 6 weeks in Sydney, Australia. Now, the way it happened, it's not very pretty, and I'm not very proud of it. But, you know, we do what we have to do. That's the only way we know to survive. We do what we have to do. You see, by this time in my drinking, I had learned what is commonly known as the con game. Now, if any of you in here tonight don't think you did it, then you're wrong. But I'll give you a little refresher course on how it works. At least this is how it worked for me. If you had it, and I wanted it or needed it, then I had it. It was as simple as that. A lot of times I'd have it, and you wouldn't know I had it. The only thing you'd know for sure was is you didn't have it. But, you know, somewhere along the way, if I slipped up and you found out that I did have it, give me about 5 minutes to talk with you, and you'd be kind of glad I had it. You know, I deserve it. But, you know, that's the way it was with me. I didn't want it to be that way. That's just the way it was. We had rented a little flat out on Bondi Beach, just out of Sydney there. And my drinking had progressed to the point at this time where my daily diet was a bottle of the cheapest wine that I could find and one order of fish and chips. And I remember it was August, which is wintertime over there, and I'd walk out to Bondi Beach and I'd sit there on one of those little park benches they got overlooking the ocean. I'm looking out there at that gray ocean, just me and my overcoat and that bottle of cheap wine. And I'm saying to myself, Jimmy, more in life was meant for you than this. When are you going to become somebody? If I could just get home, everything would be okay. If I can get home, that's where people love me and care about me. You know, I'll be all right if I can just get home. So I made that phone call, and it was hard to do because, once again, I had to admit defeat. And sure enough, they wired me the money. And where they got the money from, I don't know, because these were not well-to-do people. But I caught an early morning flight in San Francisco, and I caught an early morning flight again into Atlanta. I called a friend from the airport that I knew very well that lived in Atlanta at that particular time, and he came and picked me up at the airport and took me to the liquor store and then took me to the bus station. And I got on that bus headed back toward Wells County, Georgia. Now, here I've been gone 5-6 months. I'm not sure how long I was gone. Doesn't really matter. Any sane person would have gone on home to see his folks. But as fate would have it, that bus was riding right by Wayne Waller's beer joint. And I asked that bus driver, he didn't mind. I sure would appreciate him stopping at that beer joint and letting me out. He said, no, sir, I'd be glad to. Because, you see, by that time, that bus driver had grown tired of me. So I remember that bus stopping that day, and I got off with my sack, and I was walking across that gravel lot over there to Wayne's. Wayne's was closing. It was getting close to lunchtime, and he saw me coming across there, and he opened back up. And I'm sitting there, and I'm talking to Wayne. I think Wayne might have been my first spiritual advisor. He said, Jimmy, you've been gone a long time, haven't you, son? I said, yes, I have. He said, a long way, too. I said, yes, sir. He said, Jimmy, when are you going to settle down? When are you going to do something with yourself? You need to settle down and become something. I said, you know, Wayne, I've been thinking about that very thing. That's exactly what I'm going to do. I said, you know what? I'm going to get me probably going to trade my old car in and get me a nicer car. Then I'm going to get me an apartment or a little small house, a fixer-upper of some sort, you know, something that I can work on myself. And I'm going to get me a real good job. And I'm going to do all this. And I might even get married, for God's sakes. He said, why don't you do that, Jimmy? I think that'd be a good idea. I said, you know what, Wayne? I think I will. So I went over to the phone, and I picked it up, and I called my wife-to-be. And she came and picked me up. And on January 10th, 1969, we were married. I got married on my birthday, so I wouldn't forget it. I'm married to the same woman today. And that's God's doing now, not mine. You see, I put absolutely nothing into that marriage. All this woman did was clothe, educate, nurture, care for, was Boy Scouts for, Girl Scouts for, was Santa Claus for, was everything for. 3 beautiful, wonderful children. And you see, I wanted desperately to be a part of that. I truly did. In my heart, I wanted to be a part of that. But alcohol took that away. And I remember that conversation I had with myself. Jimmy, you finally got a family and you finally got a son. You're going to have to do something about your drinking. That little boy is going to need a father. He's going to need a father unlike the father that you had. He's going to have someone to be around for him. He's going to need someone to teach him how to dance with the pretty girls, and he's going to need someone to teach him how to throw the ball. You're going to have to be a dad to this little boy. And there, let me tell you, folks, with every fiber of my being, that's what I was going to be. I was going to be a dad for this little boy. But my drinking progressed and escalated. Within a couple of years, almost to the day, our second child was born, a little girl, and I fell in love with this child instantly. And I remember that conversation very vividly that I had when that child was born. Jimmy, this little child, this girl is going to need a dad. She's going to have to have the piano lessons and the ballet lessons and the pretty dresses like all the nice little girls have. And you're going to have to be a father for this child. She's going to need a dad's shoulder to cry on from time to time when her mother simply won't do. You're going to need to be there for this little girl. And I was going to do that. With every ounce of my being, I was going to be a dad to this little girl. But my drinking progressed and escalated. We have another little girl. I'll tell you about her in just a little bit. The year was sometime around 1974, 1975. I'm not sure of the year. My drinking had progressed at this point to where I knew that if I had to live one more day the way that I was living, that life simply wasn't worth it. At this time, I'd been on about a four-day drunk. I remember being in the bedroom that night, and I remember making that decision. I remember getting out of the bed that night and walking into the kitchen, and I remember a wife and two small children sitting on the floor that night, and I remember reaching on top of that refrigerator and grabbing the gun. And I remember that wife and those two small children sitting there crying and begging their daddy not to do it. I remember walking out that back door that night, and I remember getting into that truck, and I remember the sound of the gun. I remember it not being quite as loud as I thought it would be. And the strangest sensation of absolutely no pain. None whatsoever. And then I remember a very intense heat, as though my body were on fire. And that was followed very rapidly by the massive nausea. And then the rush of vomit and blood. I remember the sound of the ambulance coming through Washington that night. It was a quiet night at home. I remember them driving me to the hospital and taking me into the emergency room there. And the last thing I remember was my wife's aunt being there. And the last thing I said to her was to beg her to tell them not to cut me. And that's the last thing I remember. I came through a day or so later there in intensive care. And, of course, my wife was there. And she said, Jimmy, do you remember anything? I said, sugar, I remember what I did, and I am so sorry that I put you all through that. She said, I'm not talking about that. Do you remember anything while you were out? I said, no, I don't. Should I? She said, when they got you on that operating room, they could find no pulse. You had no blood pressure, and you had a hemoglobin count of 4, and you died on that operating room table. Now, I would love to tell you people here in Columbia tonight about an afterlife experience, but I simply can't do that. Because to the best of my knowledge, I didn't have one. And the only thing that I can attribute that to today is simply this, is that the God of my understanding, as I know him through you people, simply was not ready for me yet, and that there was work left for me to do. I stayed in that hospital for 28 days, and the day that I got out of the hospital, I got drunk. You see, alcohol was not my problem. Reality was my problem. I needed that social lubricant. I needed that boost just to make it through one day. Reality I couldn't bear. Sameness I couldn't bear. I didn't like life without something inside me to make life bearable. I was to stay drunk for 13 more years. I did not want it to be that way. But that's the way it was. The last four of my drinking years are probably the most important. A typical day for me went something like this. I'd crawl out of that bed in the morning, and I'd crawl into that porcelain altar, and I'd beg your God not to let me get drunk that day. I could usually, you know, make it into work, and I could generally make it until about 9:30 or 10 o'clock, and, you know, all of a sudden reality would come creeping in on me, like that burden from hell, and I couldn't bear it anymore. And I'd be out under the front seat of that truck drinking that cheap, God, cheap, 80-proof Gilby's vodka. And I'd hit that stuff two or three good times. That'd last me until lunch. And I'd be on my way home to lunch, and I'd take me a couple of quick pulls off that juice. And that'd get me home, and I'd take about 3 honks off of it on the way back. And all of a sudden, my day was off and running again. And then I could usually make it until about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'd be back out on the front seat of that truck. Now, being a successful businessman as I was at that particular time, you know, I'd have to leave early and go out and check on all these jobs. Now, what I would do, I'd get in that truck, and I'd head just straight to Billy D's liquor store, which was 2 blocks from my office, and I'd get me another liter of that vodka. At that time, I lived 2 miles from my office, and it took me 45 minutes to get home every afternoon. You see, I'd put that truck on those backcountry roads there in Wilkes County. I have solved every problem the world will ever have right from the front seat of that pickup truck drinking that cheap vodka. I mean, it was the answer to everything. I'd pull into my driveway, and I'd go into the house, and if there wasn't a fight going on, I'd start one. Somebody had to go. Preferably, it'd be them, you see, because when they left, I could put that bottle under the bed, and I could drink in peace. Now, blackout time for me was about 7:30. Pass-out time was 9 o'clock. And I'd pass out. I'd come to the next morning, and I'd crawl into that porcelain altar, and I'd beg your God not to let me get drunk that day. Now, this went on day after day, month after month, year after year, till life had become unbearable again for me, and I knew that my life on this earth was not to be much longer. I was at my office minding my own business one afternoon. A very good friend of mine came to see me. She said, "Jimmy, come go along with me. I want to talk to you." You see, when I'd get home in the afternoons and I'd start these fights, my wife and daughter would leave. My wife would go to Al-Anon and my daughter would go to Alateen. Now, were it not for the program of Alateen, I promise you, you would have a different speaker here standing here tonight. But this lady that came and picked me up at my office that afternoon was my daughter's Alateen counselor. And she said, "Jimmy, I've got a problem." I said, "What is it?" She said, "I'm having a problem with your daughter, Lene." I said, "Well, what can I do to help? I'll help any way I can." She said, "I don't know, but let me tell you this." She said, "I went to your daughter, Lene, and I said, 'Lene, is there anything I can do for you to help you?'" And my daughter's reply was simply this. She said, "Miss Kathy, I don't know of anything you can do for me. Unless you can tell me what I can do to help my daddy." I have never, ever, before or since, had anything hurt me as much as that statement. Ever. Because you see, until that very moment, I had always told myself the greatest alcoholic lie that there is. I'm only hurting myself. Now, I'll stand before you here in Columbia tonight, and I mean this with all my heart. It is my God-given right to drink myself to death any time that I want to. But the right was not given me to take others with me. And that's what I had begun to do. She let me out at my office that afternoon, and I don't know what you do. The only thing I knew to do was to get drunk. That's the way I dealt with pain. That's the way I dealt with everything. Pain and joy were the same to me. Alcohol was that equalizer. The next afternoon, I went home early, and my wife was cooking supper, and I said, "Lib, Kathy came to see me yesterday, and she mentioned a little treatment center down in Augusta. What do you think?" My wife said, "Hold that thought." And she left. I knew she was going to be left for some time because she cut pots and pans off on the stove. Well, she gets out of sight, and I go out to the truck, and I get the vodka. And I'm starting drinking my vodka again, and Blackout time rolls around. I go into my blackout. Passout time rolls around. I go in and pass out. I hadn't been passed out too long, and I felt a figure come into the room, and it's my son. He's a big, scrapping young boy by this time. He said, "Dad, come go along with me." "Where we going, boy?" "Well, we're going over to Grandma's. We're going to talk to you for a few minutes." I said, "Sure, to take my truck." He said, "No, you can ride with me, Dad." I said, "Okay." So we went over to my mother-in-law's house, and I walked in that living room that night, and you've never seen the beat of it in all your days. There sat my mother-in-law, my brother-in-law, my wife, my son, my oldest daughter, and that dang Alatine council. Now, the whole bunch now, they sit there and they've been crying. You know, I could tell. I could look at them. And they've been talking about some serious stuff. And I didn't know what to do, so, hey, I cried with them. But what, you know, what, I come to find out what these folks were crying. They were having a tribunal on me. And they hadn't come up with something that I too much agreed with. But they said, you know, right up front, they said, "Now, Jimmy, you can say anything you want to say after we get through saying what we got to say." Well, they got through saying what they needed to say, and I didn't have anything I wanted to say. I never did too much like talking with folks that knew more about where I've been than I did. And they seemed to know a lot more about me than I knew about me. I was given two choices that night. I could go to that treatment center that night, or I could go the next morning. Well, I looked at my son. He seemed to be the most rational person around at that particular time. I said, "What do you think, boy?" And he said, "I think in the morning it'll be fine, Dad." God, I was glad to hear that. You see, I had just bought that brand new liter of vodka, and I wasn't about to leave that stuff sitting around somewhere. So I tell my wife, I got to run down to the office and straighten out all this business. You know how we are. And she knew what I was doing. But I went to the office, but I wasn't doing much business. I drank half a liter of that vodka that night, and next morning I got up and I drank the other half a liter of vodka. Went down to Augusta, that treatment center. That was on April 13th, 1988, which is my sobriety date. I did not go to that treatment center to get sober. Let me be upfront about that. I went to that treatment center for one reason and one reason only, and that was to let my wife and family know that they had done everything humanly possible that they could do for me. And that when I got out of that treatment center, I killed myself and all others. That maybe they could rest easy at night knowing that they had done all that they could do. And maybe they could rest in peace. But something happened in that treatment center. And to this day now, I do not know what it was unless it was the hand of God working through those people who were there. I came out of that treatment center and I wanted to be sober. And I went mainline AA. You know, I started, there were two meetings a week in Washington at that particular time. There's seven meetings a week in Washington now. I had to travel all around Augusta, Greensboro, Athens, all over in that area, you know, over in Carolina just to get to meetings because I knew I needed to go to meetings because I didn't want to get drunk. And I went mainline AA, as I said, and I started sponsoring a couple of people, and God, you know, they were sick. And that helped me quite a bit. But anyway, I had been dry in Alcoholics Anonymous for about 18 months. And any of you who are in here tonight who have been through this will know exactly what I'm talking about. That's when the depression hit. Now, it was not the type of depression that you want to do physical harm to yourself. It's type of depression where you simply just want to sit down and die. And there was nothing I could do about it. I didn't know where it came from. It just came out of nowhere. I tried going to different meetings. I tried talking to different people. I tried doing different meditations. I tried everything that I knew to shake this depression. Nothing. Nothing worked. At long last, I went to the very best friend that I will ever have in this world, and that's the woman that I wake up with every morning. And I said, "Liv, something's wrong with me." I said, "I don't know what it is, but I am so depressed. And I don't want to drink anymore." She said, "Jenny, I've noticed something's wrong with you, but I can't help you with that. You're going to have to find the answer within inside you." And I believe at that moment I said the very first sincere prayer that I have ever said in my life, and it went something like this. I said, God, if there is a God, please don't desert me now. Within 2 weeks, that depression was gone. It passed just as quietly as it had come. A week or so after that, I was on my way back from a meeting in Augusta. And I was right out there on Interstate 20. As a matter of fact, I was somewhere between the Harlem and the Thompson exit. And a presence came to me. Now, it's not the presence that you read about in the big book. There was no bright light. There was no sound of any music. There was no physical apparition of any sort. But it was a presence that seemed to flow right through me. And I knew at that very moment that everything that was good and everything that was pure and everything that was wonderful in this world and in the next one was in that truck with me. And I knew that if that truck had rolled over and blown up and blown me into a million pieces, that everything was going to be okay. But more importantly than that, I knew that from that very moment on that I would never, ever have to be alone anymore. And I was at peace. And that's the way the God of my understanding came to me. By practicing these principles and working these steps that you folks were so patient in giving me. And the only way I can repay you back for that today is to not drink today. That's my gift back to you. Just not drink today. I had one of the best jobs that any recovering alcoholic can have, I think. I worked part-time at a little counseling center there in Washington. It was my job to talk to the new people that came in off the streets, the alcoholics, drug addicts, whatever. And I loved that job. I had decided I was going to keep that job until one of those fools told me the truth. You know, sometimes, it tells us in the book, big book, it says sometimes they will even tell you the truth. That wasn't the case with me. But, I love that job. And I love the laughter, that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. And nobody tells the story of a newcomer better than Ray V. Ray was chairing a newcomers meeting out in West Texas. And there were 7 or 8 young guys at the newcomers meeting that started at 7 o'clock in the evening. They always had the 7 o'clock newcomers meeting so they could get all the BS out of the way and get to the regular meeting at 8 o'clock. So here we are. We got 7 or 8 newcomers sitting around the table. And he asked this first young man, he said, would you like to share anything? He said, yes, sir. He said, I used to drink shoe polish. The next guy said, huh, that ain't nothing. He said, I used to drink kerosene. Lit. Next guy said, y'all don't know anything. He said, I blacked out one night in Nashville and came to the next morning in Memphis, Tennessee. Next guy said, so what? I blacked out in Hong Kong one night. Come to 3 days later in Montreal, Canada, in my car. Next guy said, wait a minute. Y'all don't know. He said, I've been married 4 times. Next guy said, shucks, I've been married 3 times since lunch. Twice to my sister. So you can't outdo these people, and God bless them, keep them coming back. We need you, We need those people. And I love the laughter that keeps us coming to AA. It's so important. But also, along with that laughter, we must share the pain. Now, the story I'm about to tell you now is true. The story of a man who came in, and he'd been on a long, long drunk. He got his car into the garage that night, and he managed to make it upstairs and went to bed. Next morning, he gets up and showers and shaves and goes downstairs, gets in his car, and is heading out to work. His wife, of course, wakes up and realizes that he had forgotten his lunch. And she grabs his lunch off the table and runs out on the front porch stoop to catch her husband. And in arriving on that front porch stoop, she faints. The man, not realizing what had happened to his wife, stops the car and gets out and goes to check on her. And in passing the front of his car, he finds the body of an 8-year-old little girl embedded in the grill of his car. Now you see, this is the life of the alcoholic. These are the things that we do. But for the grace of God, that could have been me. But for the grace of God, that could have been you. Someone asked me years after I had first told that story, what became of that man? And of course, he was in prison. And his wife was insane. That's where alcohol will take you. So be grateful that you have every day of sobriety that you do have. My son always says to thank you people in Alcoholics Anonymous for what you have done for him. He is so grateful to you people. I remember several years ago, he invited his mom and I up to Memphis. He played college football, and they had a game in Memphis, and he invited us up to the game. And we got to the field early that day, and he saw us sitting up in the stands, and he waved me down to the sidelines. And I'm sitting there on the sidelines before the game starts talking to my son. And a couple of his closest friends on the football team, they come by, and he says, "Hey, you guys, come over here a minute." He said, "I want you to meet my dad." This is the same little boy that sat on that kitchen floor that night crying and begging his daddy not to do it. But because of you people in Alcoholics Anonymous, this little boy is not ashamed of his daddy anymore. My oldest daughter, a very intelligent child, she studied one summer in college at Corpus Christi College at Oxford University in England. She studied economics and international finance, whatever the hell that is. She always says to thank you people in AA for what you have done for her, because you see, she owes her education to you people. Because you see, she wouldn't have that education were it not for you. She was not the type of child to leave her mother home alone with a drunken father. And everything that she has today, she owes to you people in AA. God willing, on the 16th of March of this year, I'll walk that child down the aisle and give her to someone else. And that she will also owe to AA. My youngest daughter, I'll tell you about her now. I like to refer to her as my miracle child. I was at a band concert several years ago, and I remember that youngest daughter sitting out on that gymnasium floor that night. She played the flute. And she had on a brand new white dress and pretty white shoes and new white socks. And she was just sitting there and just laughing and just having a grand old time, you know. The reason she was so happy was that we weren't going to make her play in the band anymore. You know, that was going to be her last band concert. And she, you know, she was just having a grand old time. And I remember it was on a Thursday night, because that's step meeting night in Washington. And I knew I was going to have to leave the band concert early to get to that step meeting, but I had to hear my daughter play. The reason I say she is my miracle child is because she was born 2 years after that night in 1975 that I had decided life simply was not worth living anymore. And if what my way had worked, the world would have missed that little bit of laughter. That child went on and graduated from high school a valedictorian of her class. Graduated from Presbyterian College over in Clinton, as did her sister. And she says to thank you people in Alcoholics Anonymous for giving her her daddy back. There are going to be people who come into your respective home groups that are going to be just as sick, if not sicker, than I ever thought about being. Please be patient with these people. Please love these people. I thought at one time that I had gotten good enough that I could look at the door, and when that newcomer came in, I could say, "Well, you know, he's going to make it." Or, "Ain't no way in hell she's going to make it," you know. But that's God's deal, and I realize that now. And you never know what disguise God is going to put on the person that he sends to take care of your child when your child gets here. The very person that you don't have time to talk to tonight, the very person that you don't give your phone number to tonight, may be the very person that God sent to look after your own child some years from now. Don't lose the opportunity to save your own child. It's been such a pleasure to be over here, and it's been a rough week. For me, I've lost a very dear friend.
from this area. He was a, and you've heard this too, we may be the only copy of the big book that anyone ever sees. If I never saw a big book, but I saw Joe McGarity, then I wouldn't need to see a big book. All I would have to do would be follow in his steps. That's the highest compliment I can give anyone that I had ever known. Joe was my friend, and I loved him. I'm going to close with the last two paragraphs of Bill's writing on page 164 when he says, "Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find here and join us. We will be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. And as Joe always said, please remember this, that God does love you. And so do I. Thank you so much."